Happy Friday. This is the takeaway for February 3rd, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for being with us. We have a lot to talk about today, including, in a minute, people in the streets across America. All those hundreds of thousands of protesters across the country making their anger for President Trump heard. The energy and the passion is real. It's something the Democratic Party by itself could probably never create. And the protesters wouldn't like to hear it probably, but you barely have to squint to see the similarities to another recent protest movement that became a real political force in 2009. Can Trump resistors do what the Tea Party did? Should they even try? Well, one of the issues that sent people into the streets in the last week is refugees, President Trump's travel ban. The rollout was chaotic and the policy was controversial, and the White House is still cleaning up the mess from what nearly everyone agrees was a poorly vetted and poorly planned executive order. White House counselor Kellyanne Conway was on MSNBC last night defending her boss's plan on refugees.
I bet there was very little coverage. I bet it's brand new information to people that President Obama had a six-month ban on the Iraqi refugee program after two Iraqis came here to this country, were radicalized, and they were the masterminds behind the Bowling Green massacre. Most people don't know that because it didn't get covered.
It's a strong argument in favor of being very careful when it comes to refugees. The only problem with it is that the Bowling Green massacre doesn't exist. It never happened. If Conway's tale has a connection to reality, it's that two Iraqis were arrested in Bowling Green, Kentucky in 2011 for allegedly trying to help terrorists in Iraq. But a Bowling Green massacre? There's no such thing. Kellyanne Conway now says that it was an honest mistake, but that kind of misinformation from the loudest megaphone in the world, that's part of what has protesters in the streets and in airports across America. Immigration policy, a white nationalist, Steve Bannon, at the president's hand, the rush to repeal Obamacare. Progressives, all of a sudden, have the fire that Hillary Clinton could only have dreamed of at this time last year. The problem is that when you try to fit that spontaneous grassroots anger into the mold of the Democrats in Washington, does it even fit? Matt Kibbe was an early leader of the Tea Party movement, which helped Republicans win big in 2010 and arguably helped them lose in 2012. Matt Kibbe says if liberals want to have the impact that the Tea Party did, protesters need to have a clear message.
Well, you know, there was a time at the early Tea Parties, and I would say all through 2009 and 2010, you could wade into any Tea Party crowd and they'd say that the purpose of their Tea Party was individual freedom, fiscal responsibility, and constitutionally limited government. And, you know, they started in protest to the stimulus. Some of them even started in protest to George W. Bush's Wall Street bailout. But it was more issue-based. And I think that might be a way that you reach people outside of your movement. You galvanize people around an issue, around a common set of values, as opposed to just having a common enemy. And I would point to something like Occupy Wall Street as a movement that had lots of energy early on, but sort of unraveled because the specific purpose, it just wasn't there, and there wasn't that common set of values that I saw in the Tea Party movement.
Matt Kibbe, how important was money in the early days of the Tea Party? I mean, one of the reads on the history here was that it was this grassroots movement, people coming out to town halls and angry, and then the Koch brothers and others came along and kind of sprayed glue all over it and provided the money to help stick it to the Republican Party, or at least co-opt it.
Yeah, you know, there's some mythology, partisan mythology around that. The Koch brothers and the folks that were willing to invest money in a social movement didn't show up until much later, and the Tea Party could not have happened without social media. It just wouldn't be possible to organize massive marches unless the barriers to entry and the cost of communicating had dropped dramatically. And that's why you're seeing more and more social movements like Black Lives Matter, the Arab Spring, the Bernie Sanders movement, the Ron Paul movement. All of these were fueled by easy access to information.
So as the Tea Party movement went on, though, there was this decision to make, right? How do Republicans include, or if you want to say, co-opt the Tea Party movement? And really, they had to, or else their own party would have been fractured. You were on the front lines of that. Can we talk about mechanics? How did that happen?
Well, that's a big question for any social movement is, do you want to get political? And I think I think we used to have these T-shirts that we handed out that said, before you can beat the Democrats, you have to beat the Republicans. And that was really the start of Tea Party political activism. They got involved in Republican primaries. And I think the upside of that is it was a demonstrable display of grassroots power, and it really caught the Republican establishment by surprise. But eventually, I think that politics probably corrupted the Tea Party. It became a vehicle for the Republican Party. But most Tea Partiers in 2009 would very much view themselves not part of the Republican Party. There was a general preference to not have candidates or elected Republicans on stages. And, you know, over time, candidates like Sarah Palin did show up on stage. And that, I think that was actually a corrupting influence. I think that sort of hijacked the values and the cohesive issue set that used to unify the Tea Party.
So what does that mean? Does that mean that liberals angry out in the streets, whether it's issue-based or strictly anti-Trump or a combination of the two, might be better off channeling their anger through Democrats and making Democrats come toward them?
I think that's definitely the way to go. And, you know, I wouldn't let any politician sort of redefine what your purpose is. I would make sure that comes from the community, and the Tea Party very much insisted that it was a leaderless movement. There wasn't one person or some set of politicians defining policy and strategy from the top down. The other question is whether or not is this going to be a hard progressive movement that sort of excludes disaffected Republicans, disaffected libertarians. They have a choice about which direction they want to go to. They want to build a bigger tent that seems less hardline, or do they want to really organize the, let's say, disaffected Bernie Sanders voters and other hardcore progressives? That'll come out, but if it feels so partisan and so far left, they're going to have a hard time gathering those other communities.
But why not get really partisan? I mean, if you're one of those liberals in the streets, or even a, you know, some experienced Democrat, you might look at the results of the election and say Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by close to 3 million. There was sort of a pinball equation victory. Donald Trump cobbled together, you know, 10,000 in Michigan, a couple thousand in Wisconsin. He can't really replicate a victory like that, or at least he shouldn't try. So lots of angry people through the Democrats might be the way to go. That might be how you swamp the opposition.
Yeah, no, there'll be a midterm election, and you know, midterm elections are defined by who has the most energy. And of course, the Tea Party wave in 2010, when, because of the Tea Party, we took over the House and in a way that no professional Republicans would have predicted. But even a political wave has to have some purpose. And so far, I see sort of disparate wings of these protests. And, you know, they're kind of all over the place. And I don't necessarily see that unity of purpose yet, but it's, of course, we're a couple weeks into this, so we just don't know.
That's Matt Kibbe. He's president and chief community organizer for Free the People, former president of FreedomWorks, grassroots Tea Party group. Matt Kibbe, thanks as always.
It's good to be with you.
Well, as more liberals are becoming politically active in the wake of the election, Takeaway producer Oliver Lazarus has been following the growth of the Democratic Socialists of America, just one small slice of what appears to be deep and broad pressure on Democrats to fight.
Welcome to the Brooklyn branch of the Democratic Socialists of America, or the DSA. Since the election, meetings have gone from small New York living rooms to full auditoriums.
When I started as a DSA member, we would get really excited if we had one new person in a room full of five people. Now we have meetings of 400 people, and we don't know, you know, we're just figuring out how to deal with this excitement.
That's Neil Meyer, who's been with the DSA for about 6 years, which makes him a veteran.
I've never seen a moment like this where there's so much enthusiasm and there's so much willingness to build a political organization.
I met him at the first general meeting of the Brooklyn branch since Trump became president. Nationwide, membership in the DSA has nearly tripled, from 6,000 to over 15,000 in the past 6 months. It appeals to people on the left who feel that the current Democratic Party isn't doing enough to fight Trump or isn't in line with their economic vision. Democratic socialism provides an alternative.
Every single person that is here tonight will be getting an email every single week about every weekly action that we're going to be doing locally in New York City to resist Donald Trump to resist the corporate backers of Donald Trump and to push back the Democratic machine.
Yeah!
We were at Chuck Schumer's house 2 weeks ago. We're going to be at Chuck Schumer's house on Tuesday at 6 p.m.
Hundreds of people did end up going to Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer's house this past Tuesday, protesting his yes votes of Trump nominees, a strategy they view as caving.
Every vote for a specific Trumpist piece of legislation, every allowance of one of his nominees for a specific position in his cabinet that is voted for, is an attack against all of the people that these Democrats have supposedly said that they are going to protect.
That's Francisco Diaz, who led the meeting. He's been involved since May 2016.
So when people say, are we partaking in leftist infighting? No, we are putting pressure on the center to make sure it holds. And we are also putting pressure on the center so we can fight the right properly and actually win.
So far, the strategy seems to be having an effect, at least on Schumer. After suggesting that he could work with the new administration and voting yes on four of Trump's cabinet nominees, he announced this week that he would vote against the rest of Trump's picks. And at least one Trump nominee, Betsy DeVos, is now in serious jeopardy. But the energy isn't just from Trump. Here's Neil Meyer again.
You look back to the anti-war demonstrations when a lot of us were growing up, the Obama enthusiasm and then disappointment in 2008, 2009, Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter.
It's also Bernie and the lingering momentum from the deferred dream of his democratic socialist world.
And really, Bernie Sanders' campaign, that there's a really clear trajectory there in how my generation has been radicalized.
It's a political path that many feel a part of.
I'm a perfect example of, like, young millennial who didn't know a lot about politics.
I was actually a Clinton supporter. I wasn't for Bernie, mostly because I thought it was too much too soon.
I was a big supporter of Bernie. It really made me feel like I needed to move towards something that was a little more to the left.
I didn't trust it. Given what we're up against now, it's like you have to realize that things have shifted enough on the other side that there's no reason why it can't shift on this one.
I think that the corporate Democrats have been a complete disappointment and a complete failure.
I think recent events, the inauguration, have driven me to stop just thinking about the ideology of socialism and start thinking about the practice of it.
I want to get involved, mostly inspired by Bernie, who I know is a social democrat.
The DSA has endorsed Keith Ellison for DNC chair for the party election later this month. He's a congressman from Minnesota and the first Muslim elected to Congress. He's not publicly a democratic socialist, but his policies are more Sanders than they are Pelosi or Schumer.
I mean, I don't think Keith Ellison is, like, the guy who's going to save America, but I think he is an interesting character. My name is Mike.
And your age?
I'm 21. I'm an idiot because I'm a person who, even as far back as May, thought, okay, Donald Trump is the nominee, so the Republican Party is officially dead, and we're just going to have to create a new, further left party to resist the Democratic Party. I was very wrong about that. Maybe the opposite is actually happening.
Say, I believe.
I believe.
I believe we.
I believe we.
I believe that we will win.
I believe that we will win.
As Reaganism rose and unions and leftist politics withered, socialism fell by the wayside. But now, with Trump as the perfect rallying figure, it's back. So the question is now, how will the Democratic Party respond? For The Takeaway, I'm Oliver Lazarus.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you. And listen to this inmate of Florida's Cell 1.
That is the last cell. That is the cell in which every person who has been put to death in the state of Florida has been housed until they got moved to the execution chamber.
That is death row inmate Michael Lambrix. Cell 1 hasn't held a prisoner, though, for more than a year, because in January of 2016, the Supreme Court ordered Florida to change the process of sentencing people to death in that state. And that threw Florida's death row population, the second largest in the country, into limbo. Wilson Sayre is a reporter for WLRN in Miami, and she decided to take an in-depth look at what happens when there's a change to the death penalty in her audio documentary series called Cell 1.
A U.S. Supreme Court decision came out that essentially said the way Florida has handed down the death penalty since 2002 was unconstitutional. And so all these questions came up. How do we move forward with cases that are pending? And what happens to the people who've already been sentenced? And while people spend years on death row, these kinds of changes really affects the people who are counting down the days to their death. And so there's a huge impact when we are uncertain about the legal underpinnings of the death penalty in the state.
Well, we're going to talk about people on death row, of course, and Florida has dozens of them. Let's talk about families of victims, presumably murder victims first. What did you learn about the psychological effects on victims' families when they're expecting an execution, probably waiting for years, and then all of a sudden a court decision comes down and says, no, that person is going to stay alive?
You know, families often want to go to every single trial and every single hearing. And so having, you know, the possibility that the person who was convicted of murdering their family member get out because of a legal technicality or be resentenced and the process just continue. I mean, it's challenging for a lot of families. Now, a lot of families that I talked to wouldn't have it any other way. You know, they would like it to be easier, but they wouldn't want to do away with the death penalty. And then I spoke to other families who said, this is crazy. I just want it to be done. I want to know that this sentence is going to stick and I can get on with my life.
Who is Michael Lambrix? Tell me about him.
So Michael Lambrix was the next person in Florida who is set to die when the U.S. Supreme Court decision came out that put the death penalty on hold. So he was a week away from his execution. He's in the last cell where inmates stay while they're putting up their property. They're saying their goodbyes. And so his life and his case has been very much at the forefront of all of these questions.
Well, let's listen for a second, Wilson Sayre, because you spoke to Michael Lambrix about his own experience of having what amounted to a last-minute stay on his life because of these legal changes.
Were you scared at that point?
Not scared. I was. It was the reality of it. Just a few hours ago, they killed the guy. And it's not just going into that cell. It's what that cell represents. When you walk into that cell one, there's a part of you that even despite all the hope that you might still have, it takes that hope away.
Wilson Sayre, what was Michael Lambrix's crime? And at this stage, is he still resigned to an ultimate fate?
So he was convicted of murdering two people, and there are a lot of questions about the process that led to that conviction. And so he would like eventually to be able to get out of prison. He is mounting various legal claims. But right now it looks like even with the sort of resolution of the limbo that Florida has found itself in, the most that's going to happen to him is he's going to get life in prison. And he says, no one fights to die in prison because that's what life in prison is. But I think it's that hope that keeps him going. I think very few people have resigned themselves to their fate.
What have people inside the legal system, judges, lawyers, been saying to you about this? I mean, so many judges, those that believe in the death penalty, say a sense of certainty is necessary, that citizens can predict that there will be a punishment for terrible crimes. That's not available right now in Florida or hasn't been. What have they been saying to you?
Yeah, a lot of judges are really frustrated by this.
We have a system which is made up of men and women, and so it's a fallible system, but it's a system that has got to look toward finality, because the reason that people have faith in the judicial system is because there is an implicit understanding that a decision will be made and carried out.
So that was a former Florida Supreme Court Justice, Charlie Wells, that you talked to.
Yeah, that principle of certainty is so much of an underpinning of our justice system. We expect that if you are convicted and your sentence is something, that's going to happen. And so when you start re-looking at cases, I mean, this just throws in not only a lot of work, but the question about the system itself. I mean, some of these people are going to have their cases reheard from, 1978. So a lot of people say this is an arbitrary system, which was the reason in 1972 that the Supreme Court said we can't have the death penalty. They reinstated that. But a lot of people are questioning whether what's happening in Florida could be something that leads to a larger, more broad look at the death penalty in the United States.
Wilson Sayre with WLRN Miami Herald News. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Todd.
You can find Wilson Sayre's full series on Florida's death row at our website at thetakeaway.org. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. And what was supposed to be a friendly first phone call between close friends went wrong earlier this week. A call between President Trump and Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull turned into an argument. Trump reportedly said he would refuse to accept 1,250 refugees being held in offshore Australian detention centers that the Obama administration had agreed to take. Here's White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer talking to reporters on Thursday.
The president is unbelievably disappointed in the previous administration's deal that was made and how poorly it was crafted and the threat to national security it put the United States on.
Well, the angry phone call between the leaders has longtime senators like John McCain playing ambassador. McCain and other senators yesterday took it upon themselves to call the Australians to reassure them that everything is okay. But the tension is raising new questions about the conditions for detainees in these offshore centers, conditions that Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and the United Nations Refugee Agency have all condemned. Kate Schutze joins me now from Brisbane, Australia. She works for Amnesty International, and she's seen these detention centers firsthand.
So I've visited Manus Island twice, and essentially people are held in quite overcrowded conditions. Both camps in Nauru and Manus are quite close to the equator, so as you can imagine, it's sweltering heat. They don't always have access to air conditioners. There's a range of health consequences of sending people to Papua New Guinea, which has malaria and multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis. You know, we've also heard from Nauru, which Amnesty visited last year, that, you know, reports of sexual assault and rape of women are just going ignored by the Nauruan and Australian authorities. You know, this raises very serious questions around what's happening in these camps, why they're keeping it from scrutiny, and why the rest of the world doesn't know about it.
Most of the people in limbo here between the United States and Australia in this latest deal that we've been discussing are from Iran. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, we're talking around 2,000 people on both Manus and Nauru. They come from a range of countries, but there is a large number of Iranians. There are people from Afghanistan, Iraq, a lot of the conflict-torn countries. There's also people from Myanmar and other places throughout the region.
And what kind of conditions are they fleeing? Why are they in such dire conditions in these Pacific islands that they have to escape from somewhere else?
Well, essentially, you know, people are escaping a conflict or persecution in the countries which they come from. A lot of them might be religious or ethnic minorities who some in cases are not recognized by the countries that they live in, so they'd be effectively stateless. That means they don't have the same rights as other civilians there to work, to marry, to own property, very basic rights that Americans and Australians take for granted.
And now, as the politics changes between Australia and the United States and Donald Trump sort of mixes in refugees with the rest of his antipathy towards immigrants, maybe similar to what's going on in Australia, that limbo's now extended.
Yeah, exactly. So we're hearing the U.S. talk about extreme vetting procedures. So those who are on Manus and Nauru have already gone through extensive vetting procedures, not just on security grounds, but also in relation to their claims. You know, when we visited Manus Island and Nauru, we found it was a highly pressurized environment designed to pressure people and force them to return back to their country of origin, regardless of the risks they face there. And sadly, some people have decided to go back to their own countries in spite of the risks. And, you know, other people have taken their own lives. And we saw last year the desperation of people as two refugees set fire to themselves on Nauru. So, you know, changing these policies, essentially we've got Trump and Turnbull gambling with people's lives. And in the meantime, those people are stuck on islands in the middle of nowhere.
Kate Schutze, researching those places for Amnesty International. Thank you.
Thank you.
Whoa.
Mm. Oh, my God!
Oh, stewardess, I speak jive.
Friday's movie day here on The Takeaway. Rafer Guzman from Newsday is here to help us through the weekend's releases, and we've got a whole bunch of them. Rafer, welcome.
Hi, Todd.
Great to have you here. We are going to talk about The Comedian, starring Robert De Niro and Cloris Leachman and many others. I have trivia for you.
All right.
Before we get started with The Comedian and some other films, Cloris Leachman, of course, is in The Comedian. So here's your question. Listen to this classic scene from Young Frankenstein between Cloris Leachman as Frau Blücher.
Yep.
And Gene Wilder.
Would the doctor care for a brandy before retiring?
No.
Some warm milk?
No, thank you very much.
What is the last beverage that Frau Blücher has to offer there? That's your trivia question. What is the last beverage she has to offer to Gene Wilder? Think about it. We'll come back to it. You can tweet me if you think you know the answer. Now, Rafer, The Comedian, by director Taylor Hatford. Robert De Niro is in this. He plays an insult comic, kind of reminds you of Pat Cooper or somebody like that. Let's listen.
I'll tell you what. Let me do it. Let me do you. I got you down.
I'll pay you not to.
That's funny. But you don't want to get into a contest with me about money. Come on, let's have some fun. This is me respecting you. You're my favorite.
I heard Harvey Keitel in there.
That's right. He plays the father of Leslie Mann, who you also heard laughing in there. Leslie Mann is dating, to put it in one way, Robert De Niro's character. You know, I wanted to like this. I like the idea of an aging comic making a comeback in the modern world in the era of YouTube and viral video. He's an insult comic, politically incorrect.
Don Rickles time.
Yeah, yeah, you know, a lot of racial jokes, gay jokes, you know, sort of pushing the envelope. If the material had been a little better, the film might have worked. De Niro's really good. He's got a lot of energy. You really believe that he's a seasoned vet on stage. But I just feel like some of the jokes don't land. There's an Asian joke in there that I found very unfunny. Some of the gay jokes seem very obvious to me. I think if the film itself had sort of a better comedy writer, better joke writer in there somewhere, maybe it could have had a little more zip to it.
Not a strong endorsement there for The Comedian from Rafer. Now, The Space Between Us is kind of an orphan traveler story. A boy who's born on Mars.
So, Gardner, when you said that you killed your mother, what exactly did you mean by that?
She died giving birth to me.
That doesn't mean that you killed her. So who's that guy?
He founded East Texas, where I'm from.
I thought you said you were from New York. Who was the woman?
Kendra. She's an astronaut.
Who you know from Mars?
Yeah.
Get out.
She's not handling that news well, but young Gardner was, in fact, the first human born on Mars.
That's right. And this had to be a secret. He's been a NASA secret for his entire life, but he's come to Earth to visit this cute Earth girl that he's met. Asa Butterfield plays Gardner. Britt Robertson plays the girl Tulsa. Again, I really wanted to like this. I love a good teen drama. Any long-distance teen romance is going to have plenty of angst and sort of soul-bearing. And, you know, this is the ultimate, right? Mars and Earth.
An alien in your own world.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Right. I mean, it really all could pull together. It's very clumsy. Plotted this film, and I think one of the big problems is he's searching for his father, and there's going to be this big twist ending. Who is Gardner's father? You know who his father is, I would say, pretty much from about the first 5 minutes of the film, so I found that to be a real disappointment.
All right, that is The Space Between Us. The Salesman, we want to talk about this film for a second. This is director Asghar Farhadi. New film. He's the only Iranian who's won an Oscar. He's been in the news lately because he is boycotting the Oscars this year because of the White House's and President Trump's travel ban.
That's right. You know, I think there was a chance that he could apply for an artistic waiver, but he has chosen not to. And so essentially he is boycotting the Oscars. And that's disappointing to me, I think, because Farhadi's movies are really apolitical. You know, whenever you watch a Farhadi movie, what you're basically seeing is life in the East that looks very much like life in the West. These movies are not, there's nothing overtly political about them. He's not making any major statements. These are just movies about people, and The Salesman is kind of the same, and it kind of saddens me to see that a filmmaker like Farhani feels that he has to harden his position against the hardliners, you know, which is something he fights at home as well. And so that's disappointing. Well, but the salesman, I think, is actually, you know, like all of his movies, a really interesting, mysterious, compelling film and very enjoyable.
And it is a film that's going to garner a ton of interest because of the politics around it, for sure.
That's
all right,
correct.
Let's circle back to trivia for a second. We were talking about the great Cloris Leachman. I played you a scene where she is trying to get Gene Wilder interested in a late night drink. What was the last drink after some warm milk and some brandy, Rafer, that she had to offer?
Oh, Todd, you've stumped me.
Oh,
I do not know.
Rafer.
Ovaltine. Nothing. Thank you. I'm a little tired.
A little bit of Ovaltine on offer from Frau Blücher. Rafer Guzman of Newsday, thank you so much.
Thanks, Todd.
Well, of course, every Friday here on The Takeaway, we like to have Melissa Locker in to help whet your cultural appetite for the weekend for all of your binge-watching and Spotify Pandora listening needs. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
I'm good. You told me that you've been thinking about the decline of Western civilization lately. Where has that led you?
It's not really leading me into politics, but leading me into rock documentaries. And I've fallen down a total rabbit hole of rock documentaries. And so I thought, you know, you and I could suggest a few for people to watch this weekend.
Well, that's great. Let's start with The Decline of Western Civilization, Part 2. This is a metal film. I've seen this. It's a little old. It's from 1988.
I like that spine-chilling feeling, that goosebumps up the spine, you know, that you've really got me. It's like an orgasm, you know.
So, Melissa, what do we got? We got Motorhead in here, Guns N' Roses.
We have Ozzy Osbourne cooking bacon in his leopard print bathroom. I mean, what else do you need? Of course you're going to want to watch this movie. But, you know, The Decline of Western Civilization is actually a three-part documentary series. The first is pretty good. It focuses on the L.A. punk scene. The second is all about the metal years. It kind of feels like Spinal Tap. And, you know, there's a part three, which is kind of focuses on L.A.'s gutter punks. But if you're going to just choose one, you got to go with the metal years.
Now, one of the best known documentaries of the grunge years, Pacific Northwest, was probably The Year Punk Broke. Of course, it has a lot of Nirvana in it, but a lot of other bands, too.
Yeah, the film's focus is actually on Sonic Youth as they kind of rise through fame. And I think people may not have necessarily noticed the film so much, except for the fact that Nirvana is featured in it. And it's, you know, it's just a few years before Kurt Cobain dies, and he's just in the film being like his kind of young, funny, quirky self. And it's also just a great story about kind of the way that grunge grew and became this massive phenomenon.
All right, well, let's take a quick trip around New York City of the early 80s, the hip-hop revolution. This is Style Wars.
It was a matter of getting a tag on each line and each division. You know, you go, it's called going all city. People see your tags in Queens, uptown, downtown, all over. It's for me and other graffiti writers that we can read it. All these other people who don't write, they're excluded. I don't care about them. No, they don't matter to me.
Melissa Locker, so it's all here, hip-hop culture, graffiti, shoes, and, of course, the music.
So if you were looking for the kind of story behind The Get Down, which is on Netflix, which is Baz Luhrmann's sort of version of hip-hop, Style Wars is the real thing. And it's absolutely an incredible kind of snapshot of life at that time.
Well, I love the 80s, of course, and you know I love punk. I want to point people, if I can take a host prerogative here, toward end of the century, the story of the Ramones, Jim Fields and Michael Gramaglia. I just love this documentary.
The Ramones were all crazy. I mean, can you imagine being in a van with Dee Dee and Johnny and Joey for the rest of your life?
Johnny was troubled. Punched Dee Dee in the head after the show if he missed an event. And Joey was troubled. He was so frail. He was always getting sick. They were all trouble.
I mean, Melissa, I know I come back to the Ramones probably too much when we do these things, but these guys were insane. It's a great film.
There is no such thing as too much when it comes to the Ramones.
And while we're at it, I'll also point people to two others real quick. There's a documentary on Twisted Sister on Netflix called We Are Twisted Sister. You do not have to like or even care about Twisted Sister to love this film, all about how a band struggled for 20 years in Long Island before they got any recognition. Also, Festival Express is the insane story of rock stars renting a train in 1970, including the band and Janis Joplin, and taking a drug and alcohol festival trip across Canada, the summer after Woodstock. It's unbelievable. That's Festival Express. Melissa, take us out on the legendary heavy metal parking lot.
Right. So if you're looking for a good double feature with The Decline of Western Civilization Part 2, you have got to watch Heavy Metal Parking Lot. It's filmed in the parking lot of a Judas Priest concert in Bowie, Maryland, in sometime in the mid-80s. And it is just an incredible journey through fandom. It's also hilarious to look at now that we know so much about what's going on with Judas Priest. And I cannot recommend it highly enough.
Melissa Locker, culture reporter for us here at The Takeaway, has been down the rock documentary rabbit hole. Thanks for dragging us down with you, Melissa.
Anytime.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turn cognitive research tasks into games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at lumosity.com.
If you are a Gen Xer or a 90s kid or possibly the parent of one of those two groups, you might know what that sound is. That's Saved by the Bell, the candy-colored television confection with idols like Zach Morris and Kelly Kapowski and, of course, beloved nerd Screech. Behind those characters and the show's memorable storylines is Peter Engel. Engel was the executive producer for Saved by the Bell and other Saturday morning shows that followed. He remembers the exact moment that inspired his career in television.
I was 12 years old on Central Park West in Manhattan. I know it was 1948, and we saw the Milton Berle Texaco Star Theater. I decided this was for me. I needed to be part of this. I had to be in television, and I fell in love.
Engel went on to produce other hits like Last Comic Standing, and he also served as dean of the School of Communication at Pat Robertson's Regent University. That's an experience in itself worth reading about. His memoir, which came out at the end of last year, is called I Was Saved by the Bell, Stories of Life, Love, and Dreams That Do Come True. And in it, Engel recalls the first version of Saved by the Bell, which was a pilot for a prime time show on NBC called Good Morning, Miss Bliss.
When Brandon Tartikoff, the young mercurial president of NBC, brought me to NBC, he was like a little younger brother to me, and he said, we can do great things. And the first thing he wanted to do was a pilot for primetime on his sixth grade teacher in Long Island, Miss Bliss, who had a major effect on his life. And in that pilot, people, it was a primetime pilot, and that pilot, people don't remember, this only aired once, was Urkel and Brian Austin Green from 90210.
Of course.
None of the kids who ended up on Bell. And that was a broken pilot. And then Brandon decided we should do it in primetime on the Disney Channel. And we did 13 episodes. It was somewhere in between. It wasn't a failure. It wasn't a success. And Disney chose not to go forward. And then Brandon wanted to add more kids and remove the teacher. And I told him to get someone else. That I didn't want to do a Saturday morning show. Who cares about Saturday morning? And the rest is television history.
Well, I want to talk a lot about some of the subtext and some of the culture behind Saved by the Bell, because it was important to a lot of young people at the time. But, you know, one thing that I always noticed about it, Peter Engel, right off the bat, the color choices in that show. I mean, Saved by the Bell was an abnormally bright, colorful show.
Yes.
It always looked to me like Skittles running around the set. And
well,
that was a choice
why.
That you made.
Well, you got to remember something. When we went on the air, Todd, our lead-ins were chipmunks, and our lead-out was Smurfs, and we got into a rabbit, a raisin, and a bear. And that was a cartoon landscape, and we were afraid no one would find us in that environment or that landscape. So what we had to do was, obviously, and Brandon and I decided that no scene would last more than 2.5 pages, because remember, it was pop, 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 pop. In those cartoon shows, and in, even in Sesame Street, bang, 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 bang. You look here, you look there. And we decided we had to be somewhere between that and a primetime comedy. And so, yes, the colors were. It's funny that no one else has picked that up but you. Yes, that was intentional because of our competition, which was a land of cartoons.
Well, there was a lot of social messaging in the show, like a lot of shows for young people in those days. There was a great deal of sort of social messaging embedded in the scripts, environmental messages, drinking and driving you dealt with, dealing with death.
We did an oil spill in 1992.
There's been an oil spill.
It's terrible, sir. Look what happened to Becky.
Please, Becky, it's okay.
The poor thing.
It's okay.
Please, sir, show us how to clean her off.
It's okay, babe. She's not moving, Zach.
I know she's probably in shock. Just please help us, sir.
Well, I'll do what I can, Zach, but... Zach, Becky's dead.
No. No.
No one was doing that kind of stuff.
And, of course, you dealt with drugs as well. This is probably the most famous scene of the most famous episode of Saved by the Bell, dealing with drug addiction and dealing with diet pills.
Pills? You mean you really are taking drugs?
I need them.
Jesse, give me those.
I need them, Zach. I have to sing.
Jesse, you can't sing tonight.
Yes, I can. I'm so excited. I'm so excited. I'm so scared.
Jesse.
It was caffeine pills. Let me explain what happened. I wrote that with Tom Tenowitz, my top producer on the show. And it was not a drug episode like the marijuana episode. It was supposed to be a peer pressure and how kids put pressure on themselves. Jesse wanted to go to Stanford. The SATs had not worked out the way she wanted. She was in every single club for her extracurricular activities. The pills were a result of that pressure. And, of course, she was singing in the Hot Sundays. When Tom and I wrote it, we wrote it as speed. You know, we're talking about amphetamines, speed, real, real drugs. And we're in the meeting with the network, standards people, and they go, no way. And so Tom said, how about caffeine pills? Now, Todd, I didn't even know what caffeine pills were. I never heard of them. And I just wanted to get the heck out of the meeting. So I said, okay, caffeine pills. We never changed a word of the script. And that's why we were made fun of by people later on that it looked like she was on heroin. But the audience was riveted in the studio. They were crying. Mark Paul and Elizabeth Berkley were crying in the scene. And I kept saying, we need another take. And in the control room, they're going, no, one more. And that was the scene you just played. Of course, I didn't write 17 Jessies. Jesse. But the impact that had on my own daughter, it was unbelievable.
So, of course, you had Zach, you had Kelly, Jesse, all the other characters. Mm-hmm. But Screech, really, mm-hmm. for so many people, was where it was at. Dustin Diamond played him. And you tell the story in the book about how, of course, this kid had unbelievable natural comedic talent, but was 11 years old when he came onto your set.
Right. I misread his birth. The thing about Bell that made it so special were the kids were playing. Well, first of all, the cast was unbelievable. They were magic from day one. And one of the reasons it caught on so well was because they were playing their own ages. On 90210, Luke Perry was 29 when they started. And all the other shows with kids, they were usually multiple years older than what they were playing. I misread Dustin Diamond's headsheet with his birthday. And after the second episode, I said to Mark Paul Gosselaar, MP, I said, what's with Dustin? He's such a kid. He said, well, he's only 11. I said, he's only 11? I never would have cast him. And that would have been a tragedy because he was comic gold. Whenever a scene wasn't working well, I would write on my notes, more Screech, more Screech, more Screech. So for Christmas, they got me a rubber stamp which said more Screech.
You know, a lot of kids who are now adults took so many different things from your show. I talked to a lot of friends who watched Saved by the Bell quite a bit when they were younger. And I had one friend, a woman, who said, I had a huge crush on Zach until I finally realized that I actually wanted to be Zach so that I could get with Kelly.
Well, you know, we send all kinds of messages. I never thought of that. But, of course, that's the world we live in. Someone asked me, would we have a gay character today? I said, probably. And I also said, I don't think we could have done Bell today as a comedy but we'd rather have to do it as a drama or something like Glee.
So that's part of the question. What do you think that show would look like now if you made it?
I think it would be a drama. Look, we had we broke barriers. I mean, I got the first diversity award. I'll tell you a funny story. I was one of the greatest fans of Belle, we found out, was Lin-Manuel Miranda. And in June, I was his guest in the sixth row on the aisle to see Hamilton. And afterward, we met on stage. I was only in one Saved by the Bell. Every year I was in Last Comic Standing, throwing people off. I was on our other shows. But I only did one Bell. It was at a golf course in Palm Springs. And I had this one line. And when I walked on the stage to meet Lin-Manuel after the show, he came walking towards me. And with that, in the voice I used, he said, "When I make this putt, you'll owe me $1,000. And we hugged and we talked. And he said to me, "You really inspired me." I said, "I'm inspired by you. Look at this cast. George Washington's black, and you're Puerto Rican, and this one's that." I said, "How did that happen?" He said, "You inspired me." He said, "You won the first diversity award." I said, "I did. If I only impacted my three children and Lin-Manuel Miranda, then there was a success." But I didn't. We impacted a whole generation in 85 countries. People forget that no comedy had ever gone to more than six English-speaking countries, Canada, the UK, Australia, New Zealand, etc. Belle was in 85 countries, and that was unheard of for a comedy. But every kid went to school somewhere, and they all wanted to see how the California kids lived.
So there is this huge impact on a whole generation. There are the bright colors on set that we talked about, but there are a couple of dark chapters in your book, Peter Engel. You describe after leaving Hollywood that you went to work for Pat Robertson, the televangelist and businessman, where you really describe one humiliation after the next, even describing yourself at one point as a convert to Christianity around Pat Robertson as the house Jew. What was that experience like?
Well, Pat was my friend. Forget politically, okay? Pat was my friend. And I was at a time in my life when everything had fallen apart. Remember, from 96 to 2001, I had six shows shooting at the same time. And all of a sudden, my wife of 20 years, my marriage went south. NBC took out a full-page ad, "Thanks for the memories." And Pat seemed to be, I didn't think anyone wanted me. And I was, when I say I was a house Jew, anything on Mel Gibson came down to screen The Passion of Christ on every subject of, was this anti-Semitic or was this negative about Jews, they would always call on me. And then, of course, you read where Pat and I got into that huge fight over who was going to tell him it was too violent in the hallway. Pat says, "Brother, you have to tell him it's too violent." I said, "Why do I have to tell him?" "Well, you're the producer." I go, "You're the head of the right. Of the violent right." And we got into, it was a fun argument, whispering. And finally I prevailed that Pat had to tell him that the cut we saw was too violent.
Well, why did you end up leaving?
Leaving where?
Regent University and your...
Because I couldn't deal with it anymore. I mean, I love Pat, and I really did, and I still do. But I just couldn't deal with the business aspects of Christianity and the commercialization and the politicization of Jesus. And that's why I did my famous speech at the National Media Prayer Breakfast, which was entitled "The Gospel of the Pentagon is Not in My Bible." And I got a standing ovation when I came out, and three people applauded among dead silence when I finished, because I said, "That's not in my Bible. Matthew's in it, Mark's in it, Luke's in it, John's in it. The Gospel of the Pentagon and of the Republican Party and Karl Rove and all these other guys are not in my Bible." And they still aren't, Todd, today.
Has that driven a division between you and some of your old friends?
Yeah. But it's okay. They're more tolerant of me, I think. And I'm being really honest about this. I think they're more tolerant of me than I am of them. Because the hypocrisy, we're all hypocrites. I don't know anybody who's as far right as I was involved with those people. And yet I guess I have less empathy for them than they do for me. And that's wrong. It's wrong on both ends of the spectrum.
So you had this long career in television, Peter Engel, through, you know, the 70s, 80s, 90s, well into the 2000s. Television, though, just in the last few years, has undergone this just absolute revolution. There's this blooming in creativity and also TV budgets. It's a totally different game than when Saved by the Bell was out. What do you think of television today and the flourishing of Netflix and Amazon and all the high quality shows that are out there?
I think it's fabulous. And I think it's this is the platinum age of television.
But don't you wish, if you had a wish, that you could be coming up now as a hotshot producer instead of 40 years ago? You know, I mean, you would have such a huge range of options ahead of you and massive budgets.
Well, budgets was never a problem. It was never a matter of the budgets. It was a matter of creativity. And comedy, quite frankly, I think those new comedies on CBS is very traditional. The one with Matt Perry and the Odd Couple and the Man with a Plan. You could have taken those comedies and put them in the 80s. So in comedy, as far as I'm concerned, nothing's really changed. It's just there's much better of everything. In drama, though, between Homeland and The Crown and you name it, tremendous production. But that has to do with the fact that the marketplace is bigger. The tent is bigger. So the bigger the tent, the more money, although it's niche television for some. I don't think money ever changed the creativity one way or the other. I don't think if ER had $3 million more a week to spend, it could have been any better. I don't think West Wing, if it had multiple more dollars, could have been any better. I think, I would want to be beginning today. Hey, we had 6 million viewers and a 5-6 rating in the demo. That'd be a top 10 show in primetime network today.
Well, the book is I Was Saved by the Bell because it's by the creator of Saved by the Bell, legendary television producer Peter Engel. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm so happy to have had the chance. Thank you.
Well, that's it for us today. Enjoy watching the Super Bowl this weekend, if indeed that's what you're going to do. Focus on the game, not the ads. Come on, it's about football, isn't it? You can always give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. Tell us how you enjoyed the game. Have a great weekend. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.